You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So appreciate your starting the work week with me, even if that work week is working from home. And for those who find themselves furloughed and without a job right now, boy, we are with you in spirit, and we will get through this, as incredibly challenging as this is from a health and financial standpoint. We turn our attention now to the latest in politics. Joining us this week, our Associate Dean and Associate Professor at Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, Michael Shires, and Senior Advisor for Emerge America, a national organization that identifies and trains Democratic women who want to run for political office, Amanda Renteria. Amanda, great to have you both with us. We appreciate it very much. Let's first start on where we are with the stimulus packages, nearly $500 billion signed by the president on Friday. But it looks, Dean Shires, like it's going to be a huge fight if there is a fourth one of these.
Well, you know, I mean, Democrats are starting to get some pushback from some of the constituent groups that, you know, they're not getting enough in these proposals. You know, I mean, this isn't a time for partisan politics, and I think that's hurt some of the initiatives in the early negotiations. So they've been a little hesitant. But, you know, this next one, especially if it centers around infrastructure, infrastructure is a place where, you know, they drew lines early, you know, over the last 3 years to make sure that Trump didn't get a win in that space. And so it's going to be hard to overcome some of that inertia.
Amanda Renteria, what do you anticipate we'll see?
You know, I think as every day goes by, the intensity of the outcomes of what's happening in COVID, it really does make the negotiation a lot harder. The other thing I'll say is you're starting to see coalitions build outside of the Senate and the House, which means in this next package, there'll be more voices as this negotiation happens, because there'll be real data on the ground of what people, what these states and localities need. And you are beginning to see groups outside come together to say, we need more investment here or more assistance there. And that does make the conversation a lot more difficult. Not to mention, we're getting closer to November, and there's no doubt that election politics start to seep into these negotiations as well.
Now, states have the ability to increase taxes. It's my understanding that, you know, filing for bankruptcy would be a very difficult thing for a state to do because of taxation authority. Why should the federal government, Amanda, provide financial assistance to states and cities when they have the ability to come up with revenue?
What you'll see is states are doing everything they can just to manage where they are now. One of the big questions about it is what's the, not only what will be the moral process of that. I worked in the Senate when the auto industry went in through its recovery process, and I got to tell you, the complication of bankruptcy on how you manage that kind of process would certainly send things into chaos, not to mention right now we need to be unifying and have governors and mayors and the federal government working together, and I think the push to bankruptcy for each of these states would really cause a firestorm and a complication that becomes very difficult for the federal government to manage, and not the kind of partnership where you can utilize state resources right now and work together in a healthy way to figure out this crisis that we've all never experienced in our lifetime.
Mike, I hear about bankruptcy, but I always thought the reason states couldn't get out from under their pension obligations and restructure those was that that avenue was not available to them.
Well, and that's kind of been the consensus for the last, you know, 20 years of consideration on this. And I mean, you know, imagine a federal judge, because bankruptcy basically would put a judge in charge of the state's finances. And I mean, imagine the challenges of separation of powers when you have the judiciary telling the legislature how to allocate the money and the governor how to spend it. I mean, it would be a huge constitutional crisis that would obviously have to go to the Supreme Court for resolution.
And do you think that to avoid all that, there's a case to be made for the federal government helping to backfill the lost revenue for states and cities?
Well, I think backfilling revenue is going to be highly controversial. I mean, you're going to ask, you know, 38 mostly red states to pay for 12 mostly blue states. And so, I mean, I think the politics in that are going to unwind all by itself. But I think on top of that, you have this, you know, every government in America is going to have to rethink how business is done at all levels. I think the feds are already providing a lot of money in terms of the health, public health response. But, you know, to actually just start handing checks to state governments and saying, here, we're going to bail Illinois or California out when they'd already dug big holes for themselves, really is going to have some uphill politics.
Well, California actually had a surplus, though. California was in quite good fiscal shape. And then with COVID-19 expenses and revenue cratering, now California finds itself in the opposite position. So it's not like California was financially mismanaged before this, Mike.
Well, it's not a function of mismanagement, but I will point out that every single state and local government, the state government in every locality was looking at the pension obligations that were coming up. And even with a rapidly rising stock market, those obligations were eating into their operational revenues by 10 or 20%. So, I mean, you know, fiscal mismanagement in 1 year, no, but in the long term, we just didn't have a fiscal plan that was going to meet the commitments that we'd made publicly.
All right. We're also talking with our political experts about the federal deficit, which, according to the General Accounting Office, has reached dizzying heights. The U.S. deficit will mushroom to $3.7 trillion fiscal 2020, and the deficit for the next fiscal year estimated to be $2.1 trillion. That's double the previous CBO estimate. Amanda Renteria, it's looking like the future generation is going to have to pick up the cost of this. At what point do politicians say, yeah, this is a current crisis, but we can't just keep spending and have people, the next generation, pay it all off?
That's right. And you heard a lot of these arguments as this administration came in and added to the drastic shrinking of revenues by a twin tax cut that folks were talking about before we had this crisis at hand. And so the idea that not only did we already start with shrinking revenue line, but this will only add to it. And there's no doubt that as we think through generations going forward, it does become difficult to figure out how we're going to get out of that hole, not affecting the generations going forward. And I think this is why every single new coronavirus package relief will get more difficult, because those spending numbers begin to become a deeper and deeper hole for everyone to figure out.
Amanda, I wanted to ask you also about President Trump's news conferences that have been so long with the health experts doing each day. He stopped doing them over the weekend after Thursday's the president musing about whether disinfectant could potentially be injected and would be part of some sort of a treatment for COVID-19. The president's supporters, apparently many of his aides, advisors, have asked him to stop doing the briefings. They perceive it as hurting his ability to be reelected because of how he's conducted himself. Do you think that it would be best for the president to just stop doing these?
I think one mark of a failure of leadership is not understanding the power of one's voice, combined with the careful messaging that's needed right now because of where our country is. It can't be overstated that the country is hanging on every single word and looking for miracles, looking for leadership, especially if you know of a family member or a friend who is sitting on a ventilator right now or who's in ICU right now. And I think the idea that when you see this president go out and talk to people, it doesn't feel like he understands that's the gravity of his words. And in fact, we're seeing that when he says the things that he does, it really truly does affect people's lives. And you are beginning to see his aides, all those around him, say, wait a second, how do we contain this? How do we make sure we have the kind of language and messaging that really understands the power of that podium? And so it's not surprising to me that we have seen that over the last couple of days. And I do hope that their words work so that we can save lives.
Wow. Amanda, just as you were answering that question that I asked, I just got a message from NPR that the White House press briefing that had been canceled for today is now back on in the Rose Garden. So who knows what's behind that, but there will be a news conference, at least as of now, scheduled for 2 o'clock Pacific in the Rose Garden. Michael Shires, Pepperdine University, your thoughts about politically how this is playing out for the president.
Well, I mean, you know, politically, the right answer for President Trump is somewhere between what he's been doing, which is daily, and, you know, what Barack Obama did, which was almost never. I mean, you know, there is a definite need for access to information and transparency. You know, whether it's the interaction, whether it's the president's words or how the media and he interact, either way, those words are getting are not having a positive impact all the time. And, you know, those are things that the president should be attentive to and make sure that his messaging are around things, you know, where he is providing that leadership and hope. I think by and large, most Americans, if you look at the polling, think he's done an okay job with an ugly situation. But at the same time, you know, he needs to constantly be mindful that, yes, every word matters. And that, you know, especially when you have a confrontational relationship with those who are conveying your words, you have to be even more careful about how you deliver your messaging.
Yeah. And I think the polling that I saw, and I think it was the Pew poll, said that 2/3 of Americans were not happy with his administration's initial response to COVID-19. But I guess I wonder, wouldn't it make more sense for the president, if he's going to be part of these news conferences, just get up, say a few words, and then get off and have his public health people get up and have them take the questions? But he seems to want to put himself as the primary figure in those news conferences.
I think he feels a responsibility to communicate with the American public, and sometimes that means he probably spends a little bit more time answering questions than he should. I think at the same time, you know, we have to be careful we don't say, well, we don't want these, and then the, you know, complaint is going to be the other way. I mean, if you look at the initial response and kind of the failure of the CDC tests and all that, possibly his closing China wasn't popular, his closing Europe wasn't popular, by many of the same folks who say he didn't move fast enough now. So, I mean, there's kind of this bizarre inconsistency amongst all of this. This is a crisis, and we all need to pull together. I mean, even President Obama stood behind President Bush during the financial collapse in 2008. And I think that, you know, this is a time for us to pull together. And if campaign politics sort of insert themselves boldly in the midst of this, I think it's going to burn whoever does it.
And you're absolutely right. Democrats were critical of those barriers against people coming into the country that the president enacted. But on the other hand, there were certainly plenty of things that the administration with the Centers for Disease Control could have implemented earlier that they didn't do that are now the subject of criticism here. We'll continue our conversation with our political analyst, Michael Shires of Pepperdine, Amanda Renteria of Emerge America. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you missed my interview with Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti in the first hour, it's at kpcc.org, a chance for you to hear what I asked the mayor about COVID-19-related public policies, as well as the massive budget challenge that the mayor and the city is facing right now. Our political analysts, Amanda Renteria and Michael Shires, are with us right now. Let's turn our attention to the presidential race, where presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden has said that he will choose a woman as his running mate. There have been some African-American leaders who've been pushing for Georgia's Stacey Abrams to be the pick. And Abrams herself, in fact, has been making the case for why she would be a strong choice. Amanda Renteria, it's a little unconventional to have someone who almost certainly will be on that list, in essence, publicly lobbying for that job and making the case. Do you think that that helps her or hurts her?
I think it is absolutely consistent with who and what Stacey Abrams has always been about. She recognizes that she comes up the political world in a different kind of fashion. And when you do that, you do have to tell your story in a different way. You do have to make sure that you're getting out there to talk about the qualifications you have had. There aren't a lot of women of color who have been in this position. And so, in fact, it does require what we know about women running, women of color running specifically, is that they do have to find their ways to tell their story, especially when it's not the traditional route that maybe most folks have thought about. And that truly is what leadership's about. It's being able to tell your story and making sure it matches for the moment. And I thought she actually did a pretty great job at doing that this weekend.
You know, and you raised something I hadn't really even thought of, that Amy Klobuchar and so many of the other women that have been talked about, they probably, because of their elective positions, have an ability for their people to talk to Biden's people in a way that maybe is more difficult for Stacey Abrams. I hadn't thought about that issue. Mike Shires, your thoughts about her tactic here?
Well, I mean, yeah, you've got to ask for the job, and if people aren't talking to you, then you have to make yourself higher profile, and that's what she's been doing. You know, I mean, Kamala Harris is obviously trying out for the job as well as Klobuchar. Vice President Biden had said he's going to pick a woman. He hasn't said a woman of color yet, and so that conversation will be open. He's going to have to do a lot of math about what a particular vice presidential candidate will bring to his ticket, you know, whether it'll deliver a swing state or not, you know, whether Abrams, for example, can deliver Georgia, which would be a really long shot, I think, in a general election. But that's the kind of math. More likely she might help him in Florida, but that's the kind of math he's going to have to be doing as he thinks about this candidate.
With Joe Biden, there's been a criticism from conservative media that Democrats have been inconsistent or hypocritical in how they went after Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and have not made more of a deal about the allegation against Joe Biden by someone who worked in his office more than a decade ago. Do you think that they are similar circumstances, Mike Shires, and should be considered similarly?
Well, the allegations are real and they need to be investigated. I think this is a horrible set of allegations, and if it's true, then there need to be consequences for it. And I think every victim, has a right to, have their claims investigated in a fair process. I think this hurts Biden a lot. This may cost him the White House. I mean, everybody wants to say, no, he's the nominee. But if he shows weakness and this continues to fester as an issue in the general election, this could hurt him a lot. I mean, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but if a Trump were to suddenly switch to a Nikki Haley as a vice president, you could easily see this redefining the landscape a lot. So I think these allegations are the big issue for the Biden campaign. He needs to be kind of aggressive about addressing them and putting them to rest.
Okay. Amanda, real quickly, we're almost out of time, but, these issues did not derail President Trump's campaign when he faced allegations and from multiple women. Do you think this hurts Biden?
This is exactly the kind of conversation that for any woman hearing this, and hearing that we're somehow going to erase everything Trump has said and all the allegations around Trump, it is maddening and frustrating. Do I think that we should hear from or investigate any allegations as they relate to Biden? Of course, in the same fashion that we need to really take seriously everything that has happened with Trump. And I look forward to that conversation as well.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Amanda Renteria of Emerge America, Mike Shires, Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, where he's associate dean and associate professor. Perhaps the unlikeliest top 10 hit of 1965's British Invasion, Ian Whitcomb's You Turn Me On. I remember laughing with my second grade friends about Ian's breathless vocal. Little did I know 25 years later, he'd be my KPCC colleague with the long-running Ian Whitcomb show on every weeknight. Well, Ian died just over a week ago. He'd had a series of health challenges and died of natural causes at the age of 78. I experienced the full breadth of Ian's talent, from his early hit to hearing him entertain audiences nightly on KPCC with his encyclopedic knowledge of ragtime, Tin Pan Alley, and early blues. His live performances on ukulele of ragtime and music hall songs, along with his wife and later his caregiver, Regina Whitcomb. Ian was also a prolific author of books on music history, like After the Ball. He reflected on Southern California and his experience of it in the novels Lotus Land and Resident Alien. His love of Los Angeles, early 20th century music, and his radio listeners came through in all his wonderful storytelling. One of my favorite memories of spending time with Ian was when I had him over to watch his 1965 TV performances on teen music shows like Shindig. His hilarious commentary on what was going on behind the scenes of the shows left me with wonderful memories. Well, we've lost a musical and radio original in Ian Whitcomb, as well as a good friend to many. I last saw Ian late last year at a rehabilitation center where he was recovering from a stroke, and I walked slowly beside him as he did strenuous physical therapy. As hard as Ian was working, he was still asking me about how I was doing and entertaining me with his thoughts as he worked hard. It's a great final memory for me of someone I really appreciate. All of us at KPCC offer our deepest condolences to Ian's wife, Regina Whitcomb, and Ian's many friends.
Every Saturday night, they were starting to roam. Then on Sunday morning, they come staggering home. On this island live wild men with cannibal tremens. And where there are wild men, there must be wild women. So where did Robinson Crusoe go? With Friday on Saturday night,
twiggy-boo, yes, betcha. That's Ian Whitcomb from all of us at Air Talk. Have a good afternoon.